This is Iconic.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things Gumshoe. This is the second half of our interview with Kevin and Emily.
Speaking of Eversink, why is it an ever-sinking city? Like, what was the nugget of, this is why this city should constantly be on the verge of destruction?
Originally, so Eversink appeared in a very different form back in a very old game of D&D that I ran, probably still in second edition D&D, honestly, maybe third. And it was really the first time that I ran a big city that I felt really good and really confident about how it felt. I remember very clearly, not to go off on a tangent, the heroes broke some law, and a bunch of guards approached them, and they were ready for the big fight. And the guards were huddled, and one sad looking guard walked forward and said, "I'm supposed to arrest you, and it's okay if you don't want to come to me and you want to escape, and we'll just put up wanted posters and stuff." But like, he clearly expected to be slaughtered. And he sounded so pathetic that the heroes decided to surrender to him. They're like, "Aren't you going to take our weapons?" And I'm like, "Are you going to let me?" They said, "No." He goes, "I'm not going to take them." He put him in a jail cell that wasn't locked. They asked why the jail cell wasn't locked. He said, "Can you pick the lock?" They said, "Yes." He said, "That's why." One of the ideas back then was that if you had a city that was always sinking for whatever reason, it was like an iceberg. You've got all that great dungeon, sunken basements full of history that you can delve down into. You've got a reason for dungeons. And I had that nugget when we started, and then Emily took that and ran with it.
I love the idea of the infinite basements. Yeah. They're not, it's not infinite, it's finite, because right, the city's only been there for so long, it's only been sinking so deep year over year. But if you could have infinite basements for an infinite dungeon that ran underneath your city, wouldn't you want it?
Yeah, it's
all
built
that storage space.
Yeah. So where did the goddess come from? Because that feels very intrinsically linked to a lot of what's going on in Serpentine and in Eversink.
That you, or was that me, Emily?
That was a good question. You came up with a city that was infinitely sinking, and I felt that that was very thematically attractive. I think Denari is me. But I'd have to look at my notes, because I have my notes stuffed away in an Evernote. Anyways, I don't know who originally came up with the goddess, but way, 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 way back in the day, like when the earth was new, I actually did a lot of ancient biblical studies and was very interested in cities all having their own patron gods, which is just very far back, or 4,000 or 5,000 BC, every city mm-hmm. has its own patron gods, the whole list, its own mythology and its own sort of, and everything like in that city was all based around that god. It could be a whole set of gods for that one particular city. Mm-hmm. So Eversink needed its own god. Well, Eversink is the city of commerce, and we had designed it so that it was all about amoral capitalism. So needed a god of amoral capitalism who everything had to be paid for with coin. So nothing was free in the city of Eversink. So he came up with the great swan Denari. The golden contract, and the renewal of the golden contract comes from History of Venice. Because in Venetian history, they believe that only the small set of families founded the city on the lagoon, and they all signed this contract. It was all going to be there, and they were all golden families and silver families. So they had a golden contract, but what was really attractive about that is that the contract expires. So it's not like a contract in mm-hmm. perpetuity. It's like a contract every 1,000 years, and like everybody has to go back and relearn the ancient language, figure out what this contract even said before they can go renegotiate the terms so their city could last for another 1,000 years. So that was really attractive. Yeah. So once you have a city of commerce and a city of merchants and a city of gold, you also had to have a city of completely arbitrary laws. So now we've got like laws and traditions, and now you're making up the laws on the fly, and eventually you're just going to get the committee of people wearing hats ruling the city. Eventually that's where that ends.
Yeah.
I had there was two big influences for me. One was a Fafford and the Grey Mouser story where Fafford discovers religion, and there's a street in Lankmar where the rank where your little hut is, where you act as a priest for your small god, varies from day to day, and you desperately hope that other people lose stature so that you can move up the street. So that was part of it. And the other part is, as you mentioned before, Terry Pratchett's small gods, right? The idea that there's all these formless demiurges out there who just desperately want a tiny little bit of worship so they can get that. That idea originally came from an old Dilvish the Damned story as well by Zelazny.
Okay.
About an ancient god in a well who only had one worshiper left, and he was desperate for more worshipers. And that really tied in nicely with the whole magic system as well, because one of the places you get sorcery is if you have a demon cohabiting your soul. And, you know, like, and those demons can also be small gods. And they're not important enough for the main important goddess to wipe out, especially if you're paying, you know, your taxes for harboring a small god. I love the idea that Denari is the goddess of civilization and commerce, but also, like, she's originally like a swan spirit who just enough people believed in. Mm-hmm. And so what that means is that the same way that she shaped the city and the people who worship her has shaped her. And so, like, the whole last campaign that I ran for my regular group was all about the fact that she turned out to, she used to have a mate, and her priests made her forget that there was a mate because they excised the story of her mate from the holy texts. And it was about our heroes finding a way to remind her about that she could make her own choices instead of being forced to do what the church wanted her to do, right? This sort of give and take between worshipers and worshipped is fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Malazan.
Oh, yeah. The Malazan series has a lot of that in there as well. Man. Now I'm going to see if I can run Malazan Game and Gumshoe. Dang it.
I've heard people talk about it before on Reddit, so I think, you know, you're not the only person.
So, you have this gorgeous book. It is almost 400 pages.
180,000 words.
How many?
180.
Nice. So, what's the one thing that, if you had to pick one of your children to be your favorite, what's the one thing that you're like, I'm so proud of this. Like, this is the piece that the gold piece that I like to pull out and polish and hold up to the sun.
You're not even seeing the giant chapter on the factions, which we had to cut for space and which will show up in a later book.
Yes.
Emily, you want to talk about the bit you love and are proudest of the most first?
Wow. I am the queen of splats. What you don't know is that there's, like, you have 180,000 words in that book. There's like 180,000 words of factions. the map, like that map is gorgeous. I was so excited to see that map. It is my favorite part of that book by far, the being able to see the city realized. That hands down, like, that's my favorite part of the whole project.
And I have hang on just a second. I have Emily's copy of this right here that I am now promising that I'm actually going to send her.
It will be sent one day.
Instead of just tell her that I'm going to send it to her and not send it. So
right.
Yeah. So for me, kind of a toss up, I think, between the freeform sorcery stuff, which I really deeply love, and I really like how it came out. But I think that if I had to pick one thing, it's the ability of the heroes to manipulate the politics around them, even as they are manipulated by the politics. I take that back. It's the ability to gain narrative control by spending investigative points. In a recent campaign, the bad guy was a sorcerer, a noble sorceress, who one of her spheres was painting. And so she was killing people by stealing the souls out of street children, by painting their souls into her paintings, and then channeling the ghosts of dead assassins into the little kids' bodies. So, you know, you had a whole 14, 15, you know, 10-year-olds, 8-year-olds running around who could not be tracked back to her.
That sounds like a Blaze in the Dark game.
And the heroes had to deal with her, and they didn't want it to turn violent right away. And so there was this amazing kind of back and forth where they took her out to dinner, and the dinner went very badly. And she killed somebody who they had kidnapped and called the Watch. And they, you know, ran back and had to hide the body. They dragged the body. So by spending investigative points, you gain some narrative control. They dragged the corpse across town and left it in her duck pond, and then broke her plumbing, bribing, spending points to bribe the guilds not to fix her plumbing anytime really soon. She compensated for this by cursing one of them to always have moist boots and by having their favorite bar condemned. They spent laws and traditions in order to have the favorite bar declared a historic landmark. Anyways, it went on from there, right? So there's these kind of large-scale political manipulation that you can do just narratively by spending the points that you have. And I like how that feels.
Yeah, it's awesome.
So you pointed out fantastic things, and we all, I think, love Swords of the Serpentine. Because I'm an American. What advice would you give for players and GMs if they're going to get into this and play Swords?
For me, I think the biggest challenge for folks is to get used to the idea that players have a say in sort of what's happening, right? That they can pull the rug out from underneath you. And we wrote it this way because that's the kind of games that I like to play, right? Mm-hmm. I have the most fun when I'm gaming, when my players pull out stuff that surprises me. As my wife says, we made Kevin make that face. And that's the face I make when they do something so utterly unexpected that I have to desperately think on my feet. We have loaded down the game to give players tools to do that if or when they want to do that. But it means that if you're a GM who's primarily run sort of more traditional games that don't give players more narrative control, or if you're a player who's never had that can be pretty intimidating, I mm-hmm. think. And I think that you have the most fun when you lean into that. I don't know. What do you think, Emily?
Well, I've always played in groups where things have always gone off the rails. Like planning for things to go to run on a nice story, nice rails, that's a bad idea. I play with a group who regularly breaks D&D modules because they're fun and easy to break, and we can drive them right off into a ditch. So my advice for players and GMs is to embrace the narrative flexibility of the system and allow the players to lean in and tell stories. And my advice for players is don't be afraid to bring your narrative self to the table. It's one of those games that needs you to bring your whole self to the table and not sit back and be passive, because mm-hmm. it really does need everybody at the table to contribute to the overall story and shaping the story so that it can be the best that it can be.
I think that one of the things I really like about the system is that it lets, and I think, Emily, you'd be quite proud of this, right, is that it really encourages players and GMs to break the city. And if you don't like bits, like, burn down a district. I don't know. Denari gets tired of one of the islands and sinks it beneath the sea, beneath the river. And she raises up something else, right? You know, collapse buildings, whatever. And I think for some folks, you're like, oh, that's actually why we didn't go through a exhaustive listing of what businesses are on what streets, because we don't give a damn. And because someone's going to burn it down anyways. So encouraging people to actually make those changes. The game is actually about how the decisions you make ripple forwards and affect the world, right? That's what the game is about. And so going into it while assuming the city is going to stay static is the wrong way to do it.
I would say just remember the roofs of Eversink are designed to be parkoured off of. So if you're not leaping off a roof or running through the Grand Marketplace and having apple carts and food market carts go everywhere, then you're not, like, it should, the city should be on fire and you should be the one lighting it.
Well, you heard it here. Set Eversink on fire. That's
a quote if I've ever heard one. Sorry.
No. Oh
my gosh, I love that. That's a lot of fun. So you had mentioned that there's enough materials about even just factions to create a whole nother book. Mm-hmm. What else is next for Swords and Serpentine? Do you have more adventures coming out, more other materials for GMs?
Well, the short answer is, if I had not fallen under pandemic, we would already have the sort of the collected adventure campaign stuff out. And that's in the works, and that'll be coming. We've got a collection coming out quite soon of all of the convention one-shots, I think four or five of those that I wrote during the game's development. So all the games that I've run dozens of times in conventions around the world are all going to be collected and expanded a little bit into one thing. We've got a fast play condensed version of the rules, along with a brand new adventure coming out for free RPG Day. So that will be free for everybody. Currently, we're releasing on Pelgrane's Patreon and then moving it over to CPageXX, their blog, series of non-human heroes, ancestries to play someone other than a human. We have four or five of those out. I've written about 24 of them. So we've got, and the secret goal here, and it's really not that secret, is to give people tools if they say, I love the city, or I love the rules, but I don't want to play a low fantasy game or a Swords and Sorcery game. I want to play a high fantasy game, right? So we're going to make it possible for people, you know, you to play your elf or your dwarf or your half-orc or your lizard guy or, you know, whatever. And some of those non-human ancestries fit really well into the city of Eversink as it's written, and some are probably not really appropriate and go better into a high fantasy game. And so those are, you know, those are being released monthly or semi-monthly. For free, and then my guess is that when we have all of them out, we'll probably collect them all into a thing. We've got material for a whole bunch of stuff about the factions and about sources of power, but not a ton of progress because I've been working on other stuff. So that's sort of the thing. I'm behind where I want to be this year in terms of getting that stuff out, but it's coming. I think this is actually another good place to point out, we've had a couple of free adventures released on CPageXX. And for a while, Emily, you were releasing adventure seeds as well on your own blog, right?
Yeah, I wrote 9 villains on my own blog.
So good. Yeah.
Project Multiplexer, so, which you can just use. My creativity got nerfed pretty badly by the pandemic. I found it really, really difficult to even read during the pandemic, let alone write. I'm finally back to consuming nonfiction at huge rates of speed again, which is usually a good bellwether for the word spigot to turn back on, but mm-hmm. hasn't.
Yeah. And I think that I'm happy with my writing. I'm not a fast writer. There are people who sit down and write, you know, 500 words a day or 1,000 words a day or whatever, and do that every day in and out. Gareth Ryder Hanrahan, who writes for Pelgrane, is a great example of that. He's written more than 4 million words. Like, that man is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And I tend to go in spurts, right? Like, I'll sit down. I once wrote 12 or 13,000 words in a single day. But then, like, I'll go for days without writing anything, right? So I would be a much better designer, I think, and that's the reason I don't do this full time, if I just did a little bit every single day, and I'm working on that. So I'm better. I'm not great yet, but I'm better.
Well, I was just pulling up the Pelgrane press site for Swords of the Serpentine, and I will make sure that this gets linked into the show notes, because, yeah, you've got the intelligent animals, constructs, unsleeping advisors, just to name a few recently.
Yeah. So unsleeping advisors are basically liches who sit in your business, sit in your basement and know everything about all of your enemies. They're great. And I desperately want to play one in an actual game.
What are the considerata?
The considerata are our version of tieflings. Okay. I wanted something that was basically plane touched. But in Eversync, it makes sense that you wouldn't necessarily have like, oh, this person's half demon or this person's half angel. Instead, the considerata are humans who in the past, one of your ancestors has made a deal with a god or demon, small, like oh, some entity. And their contract that they signed with that entity has echoed down into your flesh now. And so you might manifest bits, physical manifestations of that. You might have particular talent with laws and contracts as a result. Any number of different sort of themed things might come out of that.
Awesome. Now, is there a plan, even a pie in the sky plan, of doing a high fantasy version of Swords? Or...
Well, that's a great question. You know, I broached that with Simon and Simon Rogers and Kat Tobin at Gen Con this last year. And I think that, like, I will not be surprised if that happens. I do not think that's going to happen in 2023. Like, there's nothing on the table. It's not even an issue of, well, I can't talk about it. But I think that there would be... It would be really smart for Pelgrane to, like, we're going to have support for it, right? Mm-hmm. Because we know how to hack sorcery so that it works for high fantasy. We know how we want to do non-human ancestries. I'm guessing that I'm not going to be the person who writes the high fantasy world setting for that. I think somebody else is probably, if they choose to do it, is going to end up being the person writing that. But I think it would be a pretty good fit.
Oh, yeah.
And even if you take the rules and you drop them into, you know, the world of 13th Age or Eberron or Planescape, right?
I was going to say Planescape would be a be a perfect hack for Planescape.
And I'll tell you, the faction rules in Swords of the Serpentine are designed and originally inspired in part by Planescape's factions. It's not a hard version.
I don't think it's a huge lift. If you wanted to put some effort into rebuilding the factions out for Sigil, I don't think it's a huge lift to move sort of the Serpentine over to Sigil. You'd still have to do some work. The factions don't align with the factions that are in Swords of Serpentine, right? Those are all based on the various alignments that match up to the planes.
Right.
So there's work to be done there, but it's not impossible. It's not impossible. I think a lot of it could probably move.
One thing I'm really proud of is that we wanted this to be a game where people could take Eversync and use Eversync with a completely different rule set,
mm-hmm.
or they could take the rules from Swords of the Serpentine and use those with a very different setting, and both of those things would still be really satisfying.
Well, so I run a RuneQuest game every other Wednesday, and I'm like, if you all die... we're going to play Swords. And now that Swords game is most likely going to be set in Sigil. And
if that happens, reach out to me. I have some initial design thoughts on what to do with factions. And I'm happy. I haven't done a lot with that. I'm happy to share my thoughts.
I would love to see that just from I'm going to send you an email. I have two emails to send out. One about Planescape factions and one about Innomine because...
Oh, boy.
I don't get to talk with anyone about a nominee or Nephilim for that matter.
Or Nephilim. Like, oh yeah.
I've got all of Nephilim. They actually said that they are playtesting at last Chaosium Con. They said they are playtesting a new version of Nephilim.
Yeah, I don't believe it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I don't believe it. Is it in English or is it in French? That's an important question.
It is an important question. That's interesting because both games, you're right. Both games were originally in French.
The first one was in French.
Yeah.
Port.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a port. It's a lift and shift from a French game that's completely different than the Chaosium French game.
Well, and Innomine was French too, right?
Yeah, that was also a port from a French game. But that was completely rewritten. I have some of the original Nephilim books that were in French, and it is a very different game. It's very 1980s, so be warned.
Awesome. Hey, you say it like it's a bad decade, you know?
It's a very different time and place for game design.
It really is.
The late 1980s. That's a very different universe than what we live in today. But if they actually, I would be shocked at a new version of Nephilim. I would be floored. What a weird game.
It was asked, so we were sitting in the, where was I? I think it was the What's Next for Chaosium, and they were talking about all the new Cthulhu stuff, and they were talking about all the new RuneQuest stuff, okay. Rivers of London, and someone was like, but what about Nephilim? And all that they were said is, we're playtesting a new version of it. And I was like,
yeah,
I went there. I mean, I love Call of Cthulhu, and I went there for Call of Cthulhu and Glorantha and also Stormbringer and Nephilim because I'm weird and love, you know,
those games. Get too excited too fast, right? We started playtesting this game before we ever wrote anything down other than characters. So, you know,
oh yeah. No, I,
you never know.
I wrote a Bronze Age fantasy game and the first playtest was like 2 pages and it was still 3 years before anything actually happened. So, well, Kevin and Emily, thank you so much for joining us to just talk about Swords. It's a great game. I can't wait to get it to the table. We've enjoyed talking about it. We, you know, dissected it a little bit and gave our thoughts on it, tried to give people a good leg up on what's in there and what's awesome about it. So I appreciate you guys just taking time to hang out and chat about it.
We are so grateful, right? I loved your podcast when, you know, when you were doing 13th Age stuff and as you moved on to Gumshoe stuff, and just so grateful that the three of you take the time to sort of think through the things and dissect them and talk about them. It's something that I love and that I really appreciate. So thank you.
That's our pleasure. We have really enjoyed talking about all of this. And I think we all really enjoyed our several episodes that we did on Swords. Like that, I think for me, I expected to come out of it enjoying Nice Black Agents the most.
Okay.
And Swords is the one I want to get to the table sooner rather than later. So.
But I will say this, Kevin, since you had to tell him about Sigil, if we all die next week in RuneQuest, you're going to get some hate email, right?
I accept that. Okay, fair enough.
My only request is if you do a Swords fork and for do Sigil, can you post it somewhere?
Yeah.
I mean, you can't, like, I'm sitting in front of this big green screen, but behind me is an entire collection of the original run of Planescape, including all three box, like the big boxes.
Yeah.
So.
Same upstairs. Yeah.
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 Mine's somewhere. Mine are sitting right over there.
I think mine's sitting over there in a box with other stuff.
If it happens, it'll get posted and I'll link you guys to it.
Fantastic.
Yes. Awesome.
Emily, we should at some point, by the way, just run a write a Planescape one shot and just run it for our friends because that would be really fun.
I agree. Like 100%.
Now I want
to let us know when you write that, Kevin. We'll play in it.
That's right.
Yeah. It's
amazing.
Could be CGIF so that you have copyright.
That's right. That's right.
Sure, Hasbro won't mind. It'll be fine. It's fine.
Yeah.
They're understanding.
Cool. Well, thank you guys. And we'll be back next month with, we're going to be doing an actual play of the 13th Age second edition playtest with Rob. We'll be playing with us and that should be a lot of fun. But until then, we'll have links to where you can get this. We'll have links to Dungeonomics if we on Critical Hits, right? That's what I have pulled up.
Link to the Critical Hit site.
Yeah. And then also to all of the great PageXX and resources that are on the Pelgrane Press site. So until next time, stay safe, stay healthy, stay gaming. I'm JM, Beck and Mark, Kevin and Emily, thank you so much. We will see you all next month.
And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by becoming a patron at patreon.com/iconicpodcast.
You've been listening to the Iconic Podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, you can contact us at iconicpodcast@gmail.com. Also, check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and more information about the show. Thanks for listening.